I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Come and knock on our door.
Come and knock on our door.
We've been waiting for you.
We've been waiting for you.
Where the kisses are.
Okay, it was not TV's finest hour, or even half hour. In fact, it's pretty easy to go back through episodes of Three's Company, or The Partridge Family, The A-Team, Charles in Charge, to conclude that, yes, television has been bad for us. Stephen Johnson suggests it's time for another look.
17 schoolgirls were forced to burn alive because they weren't wearing the proper clothing. Am I outraged?
You don't get to put a bomb in Iran. There are no other issues on the table right now.
Only one other person knows the truth about what I do. Another double agent inside SD6. My father.
You're saying that a ship and its entire crew just vanished?
Well, that's what it looked like until last night.
That's the third funeral Kroner has stolen from us since Mitzi Huntley came to visit. They're after us again.
Look, they're just being dramatic.
You know, I never thought you'd call me back after that second date.
Why?
He's gotta go.
That's my nephew you're talking about.
How dare you in my own home?
Richie Aprile is moving against you.
The title of Stephen Johnson's new book explains his second look at television. He calls it Everything Bad is Good for You: How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. That's right, smarter. Johnson argues that the complexity of plots and narrative threads and the depth of characters in today's popular shows are bringing the best of television up to a literary standard that TV never gets credit for. Well, can you agree with that? Can you even think of television as something that makes us smarter? What's your case? For or against the tube? Can sitcoms and TV entertainment ever be good for us? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stephen Johnson is a writer and a cultural critic. He's here with me in the studio. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You're asking for trouble with this.
I am. I'm begging for it.
I'm still trying to figure out what you call the sleeper curve. Can you explain that for me?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the book is really the story of a trend, a 30-year trend. And in a sense, it's like the old Ronald Reagan line. It's where popular culture is concerned. You know, are you better off today than you were 30 years ago? And the book is trying to argue that we are. And the sleeper curve takes its name from a classic scene in the old Woody Allen movie Sleeper, which many people have seen, in which he plays a health food store owner who falls asleep in 1973 and wakes up 200 years later. And the scientists who are observing him in 2173 are puzzled by the fact that he keeps asking for, you know, organic wheat germ and tiger's milk and, you know, all these, you know, kind of health food store staples. And they say, why does he keep asking for these things? And they're like, well, those were once the charmed substances that were once thought to contain life-preserving properties. And he doesn't realize that hot fudge and cheeseburgers are really the things that are good for you, as we now know, thanks to science. So it's taking kind of a playful reference to that and saying that a lot of the things that we've assumed have just been kind of junk culture.
But we weren't wrong about that. I mean, you and I were both rolling our eyes at the sound of the Three's Company theme, right?
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons why I think that people have kind of a skewed sense of what's actually happening in the culture. And it's not just television, it's video games and the internet, too, I look at in the book. But the whole ecosystem of kind of pop culture today, I think, is significantly more challenging than it was 30 years ago.
What are the measures that you use when you take a look at one of these television shows that you think deserves more credit than it's getting? What are you looking at specifically?
Yeah, and this is one of the ways in which the book, I think, has been a little bit misunderstood. I'm not talking about values. I'm not talking about, the moral of the story. I'm not talking about, you know, is there too much violence or too little violence?
Swearing
or all these issues. And by the way, I think those are perfectly important conversations to have. I'm not saying that they're irrelevant. It's just that we have, you know, 1,000 op-ed pages written every day about those issues. There's plenty of conversation about that. What I'm trying to look at is what kind of thinking do you have to do to make sense of your average sitcom or drama or video game? How many characters are there that you have to follow? How many different plot lines do you have to keep track of? How much hand-holding do the creators of the show kind of do for you in leading you through the plot? And how much do you have to figure out on your own? Are you kind of sitting forward and really engaging and thinking and trying to follow and piece it all together? Or are you just kind of zoning out and staring passively at the screen?
Right. So it's sort of like the mental exercise of making your way through something like a scene in West Wing.
Whoever's on the printer, get off. Now.
That's me.
Get off.
You want to make it clear that we're pushing for Slovenia and possibly the Baltic states. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania.
Not Fredonia? We're going to leave Fredonia out there?
Point is, the zero option's off the table.
Hooray for Captain Spaulding.
Can we please...
Hey, aren't we pretty much admitting all the countries we formed NATO to fight?
Yes.
Then why not dissolve it?
You like the bomber jackets.
See, when you make a joke...
My jokes are funny.
Fredonia was pretty good.
Heard it.
Give you $500 if you perform Lydia the Tattooed Lady at next year's Gridiron.
She's got to get in there. Can we talk about sugar subsidies?
We're not done talking about summit.
It's a two-day grip and grin.
And you know, you of all people, the Russians finally elect a reformer, and you still...
20 years in the KGB in an election that would make Tammany Hall look like the League of Women Voters? I'm not sure that qualifies as a...
CJ?
There was a fire at the King Fatah Middle School in Medina. 17 girls died in the fire when they were prevented from coming out onto the street, and rescue workers were prevented from saving them.
What was preventing them?
The mutwa. The girls weren't dressed properly. Don't comment. I haven't spoken to the president, to Leo, to state, to anybody. You guys want to muzzle me before I go in there? Speak now or forever hold your peace. God knows it's not likely I'm gonna...
Everything bad is good for you. Okay, Stephen Johnson. Now here we have the printer scene and the NATO and summits and Putin and everything, and then the reference to the fire in the school of Saudi Arabia. Is that an example of what you're talking about?
Oh, it's a great example. I mean, just think how difficult it is to figure out what they're talking about. I mean, you really have to pay attention. There are a bunch of different things happening. And there's a term I use in the book called flashing arrows, which is... In a reference to this old movie I saw when I was about 13 called Student Bodies that was making fun of the early kind of slasher Halloween, Friday the 13th kind of films. It was an early parody of the genre, even though the genre at that point was only about 2 years old. And they had this great scene where the babysitter is left alone in the house with the kids, and she hears something creeping outside. And so she opens the door and then closes the door and doesn't lock it again. And then the camera swoops down on the door and then to show you that it's unlocked, and then it pulls back, and then it goes down to the door again, and then a flashing arrow appears on the screen saying, door unlocked, door unlocked, you know. And so that idea of constantly embedding things in the story to make it clear to everybody what is happening is a very condescending way of telling a story. And what you see on television is far fewer flashing arrows. There's much less kind of explanation. It would have taken 30 minutes in an old episode of a television show to try and convey all that information you just heard in that excerpt.
I read about flashing arrows in your book, and then when we were going through some video to prepare for it, we got our own flashing arrow. This is from Alias.
Now, this young man led a commando unit into FDL headquarters last week at precisely the same time that we were attacked here. The objective was the same. They were there to steal a Rambaldi artifact.
Their agent roster was compromised, and their entire network crumbled within hours of the attack.
What you're saying is FDL no longer exists.
Sorry, stupid question, but since FTL is, was an enemy for, like, ever, shouldn't we be drinking champagne?
Someone had the means to launch a unilateral attack on us and FTL, and we haven't got a clue who's responsible.
In addition, they now have what seems to be the most significant collection of Rambaldi artifacts in the world. They may, in fact, have enough to uncover what Rambaldi was ultimately working on before we do.
Oh. Yeah, that does suck.
They still exist. They're still there. But, you know, you need them because, a show like Alias is just an insanely complicated storyline. And if you go to some of these, you know, fan sites that are out there on the web devoted to kind of analyzing what's actually going on in the show, there's just, you know, pages and pages, thousands of posts talking about every little detail and plot twist and all the complexities of the plot because the storyline is so complicated.
Well, one of the points that you're making is that there's a lot of information that is included now in these programs, which were never really meant to get it. I mean, it might be the medical language in Saint Elsewhere, or it might just be extraneous stuff, and we don't know if we're supposed to pay attention to it or not.
We've learned, I think, to be able to separate out on the fly the kind of background information, the jargon of St. Elsewhere, ER has even more medical jargon, and the relevant kind of plot information. And that's an important cognitive function, actually, to sit there and say, okay, here's a lot of information coming to me. What is relevant to my concerns, i.e. following this narrative, mm-hmm. and what is just kind of background noise? And we do that, again, with much less hand-holding than we used to in the old days.
All right, Connection listeners, is all this making us smarter? 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Annie's joining us from Cambridge. Hi, Annie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, I'm a high school senior, and West Wing is my favorite TV show. I'm obsessed with it. And I was recently taking one of my AP tests for English language and was having to write about Peter Singer's idea that Americans should give more money abroad. And I was writing my whole argumentative essay and realized that I was continually using information that I had picked up from the West Wing. And at first I was like, oh my God, I'm so shallow, this is awful, like, I've been learning all of this from TV, but I've decided that I'm happy about it, and I think that it's good, and that by watching that show, as corny as it sounds, I think my analytic and skills have improved and just are at least being used while I watch TV.
I mean, are you confident that the information that you're getting from the television program, Annie, is accurate? That's part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I am, and I think it's backed up in school, and just, I see it in the news, and I think that's why I like it so much, that it really feels relevant.
Well, I'm glad to hear. I'm always happy when there's a positive call coming in the first out of the gate there. You know, the thing that I think is important here, too, to keep in mind is this idea of the trend. You know, I think you probably are getting a lot out of the West Wing, and I think there are a lot of folks who are getting these kind of mental workouts from the shows that they watch. We can talk a little bit more about it when we get back.
All right, Annie, thanks for that call. How do we connect what we're seeing on television to the news, to the world around us? Does it make us smarter if we're getting our information on the law or our information on medical things from programs like that, or West Wing, as Annie was referring to it? Or is television really bad for us? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
What is that music?
Hill Street Blues, the theme from that television show, in fact, puts us again on the map of trying to measure what's good and what's bad on television. Stephen Johnson is here with me in the studio. He's the author of a new book called Everything Bad Is Good For You, How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. And you use Hill Street Blues as a reference point, Stephen.
Yeah, it's a great comparison, basically. It shows us, you know, how we've progressed. When Hill Street came out in 1981, it was the most complicated show on television. It was the first kind of serious drama to use what we call kind of multi-threaded narratives, where they're often, you know, six or seven different narrative plot lines in every hour-long episode. There were more characters than almost all the other shows on TV. And
it just about tanked for that reason,
exactly,
didn't it?
Exactly. It was the when they first screened the pilot, everybody complained that it was impossible to follow. It finished, even though it was by far and away the most critically praised show on television in that season, it finished basically dead last in its first year, slowly clawed its way up to 30 on the, you know, in the Nielsen's charts. Never was a big hit, and finally, in like 1985, NBC actually issued a press release saying, "We're sorry, we admit it. It was too complicated. We're going to cut some of these plot lines and some of these characters because it was just too much."
Right.
And if you look, and the book kind of does this in detail, if you look at the plot structure and the mental demands that show made on its audiences of that day. Many, many shows today, Sopranos, Alias, Lost, 24, are significantly more complex than Hill Street was and are huge hits. So something has changed in the popular mind over that period that makes something that was just too much for the mind to kind of take in is now something that, you know, millions and millions of people happily embrace.
Isn't there just a simple explanation for that? We get the cultural signals now. We know better today how to follow fast editing than we did when we were watching Hitchcock films. And we're just simply more literate with the medium. It may not be making it smarter. We're just a little faster at following its signs.
I think that is true, but that's not exactly what I'm talking about. And I'm glad you brought that up because I've gotten that from a few other folks. I'm not talking about, you know, just the speed of the edits or, you know, multitasking, which is what people sometimes mistake it for, too. Multitasking is you're sitting there with your iPod and you're checking your email and you're doing your homework and you're watching TV.
And talking on the phone.
And talking on the phone. And sometimes conducting a radio interview. Which I like to do. Multitasking is multiple streams of unrelated information hitting you at the same time and you kind of continuously pay partial attention to them over that period. What this kind of thinking involves is actually making connections between different streams of information that are related. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is figuring out how all these chains of cause and effect of individual lives moving through time, how they relate to each other. If you don't make the connections, the story isn't interesting. You can't follow it. So you have to focus. You have to connect these things. You have to make a synthesis of all these different lives. And that, in fact, is one of the key things that we value in reading novels. I mean, the reason why we love the 19th century novel is because it can show us the interrelationships between, you know, many, many lives and show us the connections. And so that kind of, this is a good show to be talking about connections, mm-hmm. that kind of thinking is on the rise in television, and it's not a cheap skill. It's an important skill.
And yet you're saying it's a little bit more than just television becoming more literate, because the end result, the end game, is not to become more and more like books. Television has too many other things going on for it to just sort of mirror that, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the great things that's happening is we're starting, actually, had a piece in the Boston Globe about this over the weekend. People are starting to watch these TV shows on DVD. And they're sitting and watching an entire season, or sometimes an entire life of a series, you know, kind of night after night. So you sit down with The Sopranos and you watch it all the way through over the course of 2 months or something, mm-hmm. or you watch 24 all the way through, which is a very addictive show and easy to watch. You could watch it all in a weekend if you had the time. And when you do that, suddenly the narrative space, in a sense, that opens up there is that you stop seeing it as a show, you know, an hour long interrupted by commercials, and you see it as like a 100-hour-long story. And suddenly that's a very long, there's a lot of room, that's a very large canvas to kind of paint a picture on, and it opens up a lot of possibilities, I think.
Let's go to back to our phone lines. Everything bad is good for you. Today's popular culture is making us smarter. Howard, would you buy into that? Howard's joining us from Randolph.
No, in fact, that's my question. I don't know if I buy into it or not about the idea of television making us smarter. It's hard for me to believe that the intellectual giants who make TV are deliberately doing this, or that they in fact know what they're doing. And therefore, my question to your guest is there any empirical or research evidence that, in fact, watching TV does make you smarter?
Yes, there is some. It's still kind of early, and we don't totally know the connections here. But one of the things that I talk about in the book, which is very important, I think, for people to know, because it's an interesting trend on its own, is something called the Flynn effect. And the Flynn effect is the tendency in all modern media societies over the last 40 or 50 years for IQ scores to rise, as various other measures of things that we get from school, our knowledge of the world, our knowledge of history, and so on, have kind of bounced up and down. And the trends are sometimes good, sometimes positive, sometimes negative. IQ, and particularly kind of abstract reasoning, pattern recognition, kind of core cognitive skills that are crucial to, you know, any kind of intelligence, the measures of those skills have been rising, and they seem to be accelerating over the last 15 years in the United States. So I happen to argue in the book, for a number of reasons that you can get into if you get a chance to read it, that there is a connection between the exposure we're getting to more complex forms of media and this rise in IQ. It is an unproven idea, but a number of other people believe it as well. But the key thing to remember is people often say to me, you know, how can pop culture be making us smarter when everybody is getting more stupid? And in fact, by that crucial measure of intelligence, not the only measure of intelligence, but by that crucial measure, we are getting smarter. And I suspect, actually, the kids who are growing up with interactive software and video games, training their brains in all these other ways, I think we'll find that they are even sharper than we are.
What do you think, Howard?
It may be that we're using a too limited definition of smart. I mean, does smart refer to ability to reason analytically? Does it refer to your store of facts? I have great difficulty. I mean, I am over 50. I look around me, and I have great difficulty imagining that people are getting smarter. Just go to your supermarket any day of the week. People can't use the self-scanner. They can't figure it out. They can't, you know, I mean, it's just, I mean, people can't even understand technologies that are 60 years old, like photocells that control moving belts.
Do you watch a lot of television, Howard?
No. To me, is mostly garbage. So I watch maybe two or three shows. I used to watch Hill Street Blues, NYPD Blue.
Yeah.
I watch the first half of Law & Order because I like Dennis Farina as an actor. And I don't know. Those are the two main shows I watch. TV is to me, it's mostly nonsense.
I mean, because part of the interesting part of Stephen's argument, and Stephen, let me come back to you with this, is that when you measure the amount of time that people are watching television, and if we go with the earlier assumption that television made us all stupider, right, then if you've got a group of people who, in fact, are spending, not like Howard, but many people are spending 20, 30, 40 hours in front of the television, are you saying then by using the IQ measure, we really ought to be going down, not up?
Yeah, I mean, there was a prediction that people started making in the 70s when there was the initial kind of backlash against television, which said, you know, where suddenly these kids are growing up watching an immense amount of television and their brains are going to just kind of rot away by watching all this stuff. And we should have seen, if that were the case, a major kind of societal collapse on some level. And I'm of the generation that kind of grew up in that period. I mean, I was born in 68, and, I watched TV a lot when I was a kid. I didn't watch a ton of it, but I watched it. You know, I grew up on, you know, watching Fantasy Island and Joni Loves Chachi and all those horrible shows. And somehow I managed to survive. And, in fact, you know, if you look at these younger generations, and particularly the younger generations that are learning, you know, the digital world and the computer kind of networked world and the game world, there is no evidence that they are having major cognitive difficulties. There is some evidence of attention deficit problems that some of them may have because they grow up in a multitasking environment. When they have to move to a single-tasking environment, it's harder for them. But by a whole host of measures, they're doing very well. Even verbal SAT scores are up significantly. Math SATs are way up over the last 10 years. And violence is way down. So by a lot of different yardsticks, the health of the younger generation that are playing these violent video games and watching this junk television they're doing fine, thank you very much.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina. Adrian's with us. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
I wanted to say two things. I wouldn't say smarter is probably the best word. I would say sharper. People are quicker in picking up little cultural inferences because my main call, I wanted to call about The Simpsons, which is my all-time favorite show, and it's one of those things that it starts in one place, is in the middle in a totally other, and ends in a third completely final place that's completely nowhere where it began or was in the center. And so I wanted to just say that was probably one of the most important cultural icons that I wanted to talk about just because it's so fast and you have to be fast and you can watch it over and over again and get a new joke every time.
So could you make the argument, though, Adrian, that maybe watching a Simpsons episode once or twice or tuning in on a regular basis does make you smarter as well as sharper? I get the sharper point. I think I agree with that. But what about taking the smarter thing strictly on the face of The Simpsons?
Getting smarter?
Yeah.
Possibly. I think it could make you more well-informed, even though you have to be well-informed to get 9/10 of the jokes, because half of the jokes would be nonsensical if you didn't understand what they were making fun of in the first place.
I think you
kind of have to do research if you want to find it funny.
I think actually there's a great connection between what you just said and what Howard was calling in his initial point of why are these people making these shows smarter in the first place? I mean, you said a very key thing, which is that you can watch The Simpsons multiple times and still see something new every time. And this is one of the key points in the second half of the book that I make, which is that we have moved from a model where television is all about, you know, watching something once, you know, and basically a live broadcast of it coming down, you know, and you only see it once. You know, you only watch one episode of Charlie's Angels when it appeared, you know, the first time around, to a situation where we have all these technologies that let us watch things multiple times. You see them in syndication. You watch The Simpsons episode six times or something like that. You buy it on DVD. You buy Sopranos on DVD. And so suddenly there is an economic incentive to make things that are fun to watch multiple times, to make programming that can sustain multiple viewings. And that means making them more complex because Three's Company, frankly, is just not all that fun to watch the first time around, much, much less the fourth time around. Whereas, as the caller says, The Simpsons is a fascinating show because you can watch it five times and go, oh, my God, I never got that Orson Welles reference in that one scene. And so for the first time, really, in television's history, there's an economic reward for making things that are more complex, not less so.
And you think that the television executives that Howard referred to earlier are looking at the audience and saying, how do we get more people to watch our programs and the that one of the answers that they've come up with is that they need to be better, they need to be smarter, they need to be faster and more challenging?
Absolutely, and particularly because they're really worried about losing the 18 to 30-year-olds. This is the group that is watching less television, actually, because they're doing all these other things. And we're not going to talk that much about video games, but if you're interested in the book, I talk a lot about games because the games are really mentally challenging these days. We spend a lot; they involve a lot of thinking and a lot of puzzle work and working through these complex problems. People have no idea how complicated the games are who haven't played them. And that generation, the generation that has grown up playing games, now comes with the expectation that their entertainment should challenge them. Right? They expect to be mentally challenged by the stuff they do for fun. And so when you sit those people down in front of Three's Company, they're going to be bored too. And so I think the network executives have grown aware of the fact that people like to be challenged now and that the younger kids really do like, complex shows like Lost right now. That's the big rage. That's a really complicated narrative. There's lots of mystery to it.
You're saying some of that comes from a discovery that a 12-year-old made that by holding Game Boy and realizing that Super Mario was going to take 100 hours to figure how to get up to level 5. They bring that same expectation to television that we want depth, we want levels, we want we just don't want a simple narrative.
That's right. I really believe that there's a kind of a lateral effect that's happening, that you grow up in an environment where your entertainment is about challenge and mental exercise. And so when you shift over into the old boob tube kind of mentality and you're just watching, the A-Team, which I had not thought about until you guys
mentioned it.
No, it's great. It adds to my repertoire of horrible shows. That one's for the 80s. The A-Team just doesn't offer that kind of challenge, and those people aren't going to be satisfied.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Charlotte's joining us. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi.
So?
I had a quick question about Marshall McLuhan's statement that the medium is the message.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not the passive uptake and the bypass of cognitive censoring plays a part in any way that television really isn't helping our IQs at all?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I talk about McLuhan a couple of points in the book. He's an obvious reference. You have to wrestle with him in some way anytime you talk about mass media. And I think that my ultimate feeling about all of this is that the interactive media is really the most mind expanding of all the things that are happening, and that people who are composing emails and posting to their weblogs and playing some of these games and learning software, that's a genuinely rich environment because it's interactive and not purely passive. What's happened is that television, which was a supremely passive medium when McLuhan was writing in the 60s, has tried to do as much as it can to become more interactive and more challenging, even though there is a fundamental kind of limit there. But people are even supplementing their television watching with their internet time, so that they watch The Apprentice on TV, and then they go and they discuss it online, and so they're not just passively watching.
We used to look at that and say that's just an obsession. That's like getting far too involved with what's a TV show. But you're saying that there's more going on there than
I'd rather a
Trekkie and dressing up like the characters.
Hey, the Trekkies are running the country now in terms of the business. I mean, all the great companies in the tech sector are all run by people who were totally into video games and Star Trek and Dungeons and Dragons. So they seem to have done pretty well. But I would rather have people. We used to say in the days of when we talked about media literacy, is the idea is, not to just passively consume, but to think about it and engage. If you're going to watch television, try and do it in a critical way and in an engaged way and to actively think about it. And now that's something that's spontaneously happening on websites all around the world, of people really taking their shows seriously and thinking about them and arguing about them and working through issues. And when you look at, I quote from a fan site for The Apprentice in the book, and I talk about this discussion they're having about.
I can't even follow what they're saying in that.
You're right, but it's talking about the business ethics, basically, and whether somebody is reliable and whether they should be trusted. And they're actually talking about serious issues. They're having a real conversation about real-world issues sparked by an admittedly somewhat silly show, but it's leading them into a real conversation with real other people.
Quick check with Charlotte there. I don't know. Charlotte, is that persuasive for you at all?
I certainly wouldn't have made it through my PhD without television to watch to make me dumber for a few minutes. But my question is, what about younger, and I'll take this off the air, what about younger people that don't have the cognitive processing to be able to block out the passivity of television and don't know how to interact, whereas somebody who's older like me, I have the ability to think through.
What's young, what's old by your definition here, Charlotte?
Could you repeat that?
What is young? What's old by your definition?
Oh, like a two-year-old. I have a niece, and we're very concerned about letting her watch too much television or too much Disney because we want her to have an engaged brain.
All right, we'll pick that up when we come back after the break. Stephen Johnson is here with me. We're talking about his book, Everything Bad is Good for You, in which he makes the argument that popular culture is actually making us smarter. Can you buy that argument? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
You got the audio file?
No.
What do you mean, no? Are you telling me that there's no audio file on that chip?
There were. They were destroyed when the chip was damaged.
Michelle was able to trace a sequence back to a hacker named Alex Hewitt.
You think this is the technician that created the Cypress audio file?
Yes.
So the argument is made that by watching programs like 24, you can actually learn something, become a little smarter instead of a deadhead watching too much of the blue light coming across the living room. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Stephen Johnson is here with me in the studio. His new book is called Everything Bad is Good for You. And we should pick up Charlotte's question because it's a good one. And you're a father of little kids as well. So this must be something that you're thinking about. The idea that the Disney video playing as a sort of endless loop as a babysitter must be a mind-deadening thing.
The joke we have in our house is that when our kids get a little bit older, they're going to be like, Dad, I don't want to play any more video games or watch any more TV. I want to read this novel. No, it's a really serious question. And first off, I would bracket off. The caller was talking about a two-year-old, and I think certainly under two, you're in a zone where probably a lot, particularly under one, a lot of exposure to TV is not a good idea. But I think, you know, one of the reasons I wrote this book, it's kind of almost like a stealth parenting guide in a way for parents who, you know, want their children to be engaged in the popular culture because that's the oxygen that the kids breathe, you know, and always has been. But they want to figure out a way to do it, and that will kind of seek out the stuff that's good, that's not just that's not just total garbage, but that's not educational programming on some level. And so I tried to write a book that would be helpful in kind of setting up the standards and the criteria for finding that stuff and figuring out what is worthwhile in the culture. And one of the things for little kids, I mean, I have a 3.5, almost 4-year-old. And we have watched Finding Nemo 100 times in our house. And it's I had a period on about the 20th viewing where I was convinced that it was the greatest movie that had ever been made because it really plays equally well to 36-year-olds, 16-year-olds, and 3-year-olds. It has all these different characters. It has all these wonderful different plots. It actually has great values in addition to being complex. It's beautifully made. It's funny on all these different levels. It has kind of Simpsons-like references to pop culture that I pick up that my son doesn't totally pick up yet. And what's great about it, and this is the great opportunity that I think we have, that parents have right now, is that there's a possibility to share the culture with your child in a way that it was much harder to do 30 years ago. That I really do genuinely enjoy watching it, maybe not for the 80th time, but I did enjoy it for the first 20 or so.
Okay, I want to go back to our callers, but yeah. I have one question about that because you use Finding Nemo as a reference in the book when you say it's never going to be Moby Dick. And I guess that's the sort of the bigger question here. It may be better than we think it is. It may be making us smarter, but it's still television entertainment. So what's the gap that exists there?
Well, that's why I've tried to say up front that I'm talking about a trend. And if we were all sitting around in 1977 reading Middlemarch and then fast forwarded to today's culture, I would say absolutely it has gotten worse. But the truth is we were not sitting around watching Middlemarch, reading Middlemarch. We were sitting around watching, The A-Team and Joni Loves Chachi. So, for all the people who say the sky is falling and everything has gotten worse, actually it's getting better. It is not a perfect society. And we still don't get a lot of wisdom, I think, and life lessons and important moral values and American history and all these things from our pop culture. But that's why we have schools and pastors and parents. All those people are still there. It's just that the part of the culture that we had totally written off is actually training our brains in some important ways that we shouldn't, be quick to dismiss.
Back to the calls. To Louisville, Kentucky, Brian's on the line. Hello, Brian.
Hi.
Tell me what you think.
Oh, well, actually, I was curious if you had spent any time exploring the creativity of maybe science fiction programs or even anime programs that may be delivering newer concepts or foreign or unusual concepts that had not been really examined or explored the media before.
Or aren't part of the mainstream right now.
You know, it's a great question, and I've had a couple of people ask me about it. I really don't deal with it in the book, and that I think is partially just my personal bias in some sense. I actually start the book with this anecdote about playing these dice baseball games that I played when I was 9, and I spent an immense amount of time playing and designing, ultimately started kind of designing these games that you'd simulate baseball by having all these charts and statistics and so on and so forth. And I'm convinced that I got more out of that at that period of my life in terms of thinking and reasoning and building models of complex systems than I did out of anything I was learning in school. And that's kind of the beginning of the story of that kind of thinking has become much more common thanks to so many of the forces I'm talking about. But I could have, if I'd been a different kid, I could have told the same story about Star Trek and Dungeons and Dragons and a bunch of these kind of sci-fi games and adventures that just were a slightly different sensibility than the sensibility I had. A lot of people have said to me, Star Trek is the beginning of the sleeper curve that you're describing, and they may well be right. They may well be right.
Where would you mark it, Brian? How do you? What's the importance of the science fiction in your mind?
Well, I think that the exploration of just these foreign concepts people don't deal with on a daily basis. I mean, I believe that has a direct link to the educational level. I mean, to explore exploration is learning in and of itself, and so therefore I'm interested to know, you know, if you had explored anything like that. There's a wonderful program, Farscape, made by the Jim Henson Company, and not only with the technology that is available today do they deliver more stunning visuals, etc. It doesn't necessarily have to be about combat or anything like that, but it's about seeing something that you hadn't before or exploring something that you hadn't. The old Star Trek series, Gene Roddenberry was very much focused on dealing with issues of the day but translated through a sci-fi medium.
So I mean, if we put this in terms of just talking about imagination, you can look at this from two sides. You can say that the good side of what Brian's describing is that it challenges your imagination, gets you thinking outside whatever your neighborhood box is. On the flip side, you'll have people saying, they're doing your imagining for you, and I don't know where you come down on this.
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot. I think about games in this context, because that's where people really do feel that, because you get to really drive the experience, and it seems like all the imagining is being done for you. And I think about, you know, what would I rather have? You know, when I was a kid, I would pretend that I was, you know, a jet pilot, and I would sit on my bed and kind of, you know, pretend that I was flying a plane, and it was all in my head, and I suppose there was something good about that, but I really was not learning anything at all. There was no feedback from the world. I could just the plane would do whatever I wanted. And now you have kids who really actually could fly a plane if you put them right in it, because the flight simulators are so good. And they're learning about not only how to fly the plane, but learning how to reason through the whole system and learning about kind of the physics of flight and all these things.
And how to shoot people down at the same time.
And how to shoot people down at the same time. So they get that too if they go into the military. But I think that also, when those kids imagine what it's like to fly, they really know something about it. And they've really had, you know, training in a sense that tells them what's right and what's wrong, and it's not just this kind of flight of fancy. And I think I probably would opt for that if you have to choose. And of course, we don't necessarily have to choose. So
let's go back to television, and we'll do that with Dina, who's calling in from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Dina. What do you think?
I was wondering how the author could explain the popularity of so many shows on TV that are frankly inane and voyeuristic and. Just for me, I find them very uncomfortable to watch, but they seem to get good ratings, as well as the ones like Lost and West Wing, who engage people in a different manner.
Which ones do you want to talk about, Dina? Are you talking about Fear Factor and the makeover shows? You're talking about
exactly, and the nanny and the, you know, the crazy children and all those things. Those things are also popular, and I don't really see how they can be contributing to our intelligence or why people who watch shows like Lost also are engaged by shows, you know, where they're watching people's personal disasters or eating odd things or whatever.
Well, I think, you know, Fear Factor is a genuinely lame show, and there are always going to be, you know, bad shows on TV. The question is, you know, are some of these shows, how do they compare to where they were 30 years ago? I don't think anybody is getting smarter from watching Fear Factor. Certainly that's true. But there were really some horrible shows on the air 30 years ago, and so you have to compare, you know, the lemons to the lemons to really make this work. So you have to look at Fear Factor and compare it to, you know, The Newlywed Game or Battle of the Network Stars or some of the just, you know, kind of useless shows that were on the air. And the other thing is there's more programming available on TV today, and so there's more stuff at the bottom of the barrel because there's just more stuff in the barrel in a sense. There's more stuff at the top of the barrel as well. So, you know, for every show like, you know, The Simple Life with Paris Hilton, there's a Discovery Channel. There was nothing like that that was on the TV except for, you know, occasional special on PBS before. So the diversity of the overall ecosystem has changed. And I would just say that, you know, that because so many of these dramas and some of the sitcoms have been huge hits, if you look at the Nielsen ratings, that on balance, television has gotten more complicated.
And would you say that, based on your research, that the ratings show enough people are paying attention to the high-end stuff that there's value in the medium? Or are we only talking about 5 or 10% of the television-watching public who are amusing themselves with West Wing and 24, as opposed to, you know, saying, you know, Desperate Housewives is the height of their cultural exposure in a given week?
I would just, you know, take each genre and compare it to the equivalent hit show from 30 years ago. So, you know, there's no question to me that that the kind of soap opera-like shows like Sopranos are much more interesting and stimulating and complex than Dallas was. You go back and watch Dallas, and it's tedious. You can't believe it was ever a big, hot show. It's just really dull. The reality shows are basically game shows. That's what they are. They're contestants kind of vying for a prize. And I will take The Apprentice and Survivor, which really are kind of interesting, smart shows on a host of levels, and spontaneous and unpredictable shows where there's psychological kind of intrigue and you're following
the characters. You'll take that over Hollywood Squares?
I'll take it over Hollywood Squares any day. So on all those different, you know, if you do this side by side, I think the trend is good still.
1-800-423-8255. Where are we going next? To Boston. Josh is with us. Hi, Josh.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, there's one particular genre of shows that you folks have made a couple references to as among the some of the more interesting and intelligent shows. It's a genre that presents a mystery. And I often feel tricked. I often feel lied to, that the intelligence is sort of a fake intelligence and that there's a sequential taunting, a false promise.
Give me an example of what you're talking about, if you can, Josh. Give me an example.
Sure. I think it's a genre that might have been invented by X-Files. And now I think I see it being carried on in the likes of Alias and Lost. And I can't think. I think that there have been others that also sort of have carried out this formula, where I think the purpose of the show, perhaps the purpose of any show, is to keep us watching. But I feel like the method of keeping us watching is in large part a false promise, something that can never be fulfilled because the fulfillment of the promise would basically be the end of the show. And for myself, it has a cumulative effect. So while I was deeply engrossed in X-Files, as I see this happening in shows like Alias and like Lost, it's having a cumulative effect where I might have been very long-term engaged in those shows, but I'm expecting to be let down ultimately, that the promise is a false promise and that the mysteries not only won't get resolved, but they won't even be dealt with in a way that's ultimately interesting.
There was kind of an interesting back and forth in Slate when Stephen took on Dana Stevens, and they were arguing about the basic premise of the book here, Josh, and the point that Dana Stevens made, which I think is a way of crystallizing what you're saying, is that none of this makes us smarter. It just makes us want to watch more TV. Might make us better at watching TV, but it just makes us watch more. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I disagreed with Dana, but that was a fun conversation. The analogy that I use in the book is to say that, you know, that the kind of exercise we're getting is a little bit like the way we talk about playing chess. On some level, you can say if you play chess, you learn to play better chess. And there's no life lessons that you get from chess. And the narrative of chess is even more predictable. It always ends the same way. But most of us, I would think, agree that there's something mentally, you know, worthwhile about playing chess, that it exercises the mind in a kind of an abstract way. And so while the content isn't interesting, the exercise is. And, you know, I think the caller is hit on something that's very interesting and probably is right, that because the shows have gotten so good and so, you know, just interesting and stimulating on some level, I think we almost want them to deliver the aesthetic and kind of intellectual payoff that you would get from reading a 19th century novel, to use Middlemarch again. And they don't deliver that. I think that's right. I think that, you know, the X-Files was fascinating and engaging, but you don't, at the end of it, feel that you've gotten something beyond the mental workout. But again, I hate to keep bringing this up, but we weren't even getting the mental workout 30 yeah. years ago, so at least we're getting that, and we have lots of other things in the culture that can supply that for
us. But that's part of the business of stripping away what it is that you're not talking about and focusing what you are talking about. When you talk about nutrition in television programs, you're not talking about what kind of social value and sort of changed way of looking at the world do I take? What do I learn from that? In effect, what you're talking about is, am I any better at making sense of this? Is it better brain exercise? Is that right?
Yeah, and making sense of things that can be usefully. Are you creating faculties in your mind that can be usefully applied to the outside world? So I talk about the social network you have to keep track of in an episode of 24, all the number of characters, all the relationships between the characters, the different kind of feuds and battles and alliances between the characters. And I show in the book that it's, you know, vastly more complex than it was in a show like Dallas, which was very complex for its day. Now, that is not a trivial talent. People who map social networks well in their heads tend to be very successful in life. They tend to be very good at dealing with office politics and dealing with family politics and dealing with all the things that you need to do as a kind of social animal. And so it's a non-trivial skill. And if we can show that the television programs are getting better at exercising that skill and that skill is transferable to the real world, then that's great. If we're getting that from our off time, that should be cause for celebration. It's not cause to just sit around and watch television all day. I mean, what the other message to parents is, you know, make sure you have a balanced media diet, you know, that you don't, if your kid is watching 20 hours of TV during the week, you know, tell them to pick up a book, of course. But respect the fact that there is something that they can get from these things, from the games and the interactivity and from the TV, if they're watching the right things.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. There's one point that I want to go another step forward with you on, and that is you're talking about parents and what they see. But even if we're talking about the parents of teenagers, we've both had that experience, Stephen, of walking into a room where other people are in the middle of watching a television program. And there is that sort of horrifying look on the face of people who are engrossed in something, whether it's Fear Factor or West Wing. The mouth kind of hangs open and the eyes have this glassy look at it. And I think a lot of people think of that look on a person's face when they make a judgment about the content or the quality of what it is they're watching on television.
It's amazing how often people invoke the look as if that is a clear empirical kind of indication. And I would ask people actually to take a look at somebody reading and ask me how different they look, really. They're focused, they're quiet, they're not talking to people around them, their eyes are moving back and forth. That's the only thing that's really different in their look. So it's not necessarily an indictment, just the way people are staring.
Everything Bad is Good for You, How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. Book by Stephen Johnson. Thanks so much for coming in. Nice to have you here.
My pleasure.
And The Connection is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Matson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Schuchertz, with help this week from Patrick Kiker. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.